Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2021 Youth Education Conference held in Orem, Utah.
I'm Sam Martineau, teach debate classes, have done that for a long time, blah, 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 moving on. Okay, so in World War II, there's this really interesting thing that happens. They have the, oh, and by the way, if you wanted to take notes, apparently my page is 59, so I didn't put anything on there because, I don't know, I just wanted you to be able to take whatever notes you wanted. So here we go. In World War II, they have this really interesting thing that happens. They want to do a study on how to make planes, the fighter jets that they're using, to be more effective, to just specifically have better defenses. And they want to, they know that they, within their tolerances, they can put some more armor on it, but they can't put lots more armor on it, right? Because that would make it too heavy. So they have to decide where it is that they're going to put this armor. So what they do is they take all the planes that have been shot at, and they diagram out where all the bullet holes are, and they think, okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to armor those places where we're getting bullet holes. Sounds pretty reasonable, right? Obviously, if it's getting shot in one place, you put the armor on it, it's going to be better, easy. False. It's actually a terrible, terrible idea. So what ends up happening is they also have this Hungarian statistician, I can't remember his name, Wald or something like that, I don't remember. Anyway, this Hungarian statistician, they bring him on board to the project as well, and they're like, okay, we want you to look at this. And he is like, guys, you are thinking about this all wrong. It's just, you are not getting this at all. First of all, has anyone heard this one before? No, you have? Okay, good. Outside of you, anyone want to venture a guess? Obviously, you would already know. But anyone want to venture a guess as to what's wrong here? Okay, so good. Put your hands down. You nailed it on the head. Yes, you are only seeing the planes that got back. You're not seeing the ones that are crashing and burned. And so what's the logical conclusion here? If you're armoring the planes that got back in the places they got shot, you're armoring the parts that don't matter. Like, apparently, you can get shot in those places. Doesn't matter. You can keep going. So they have these a lot of the shots that they were thinking about armoring were like on the wings, the fuselage, the tail. Interestingly enough, not the engine, because if you get shot in the engine, yeah, it blows up and you fall, you crash and burn, you die, right? So actually, they do. So they take a suggestion. They armor the other parts. Ends up increasing survivor rates. It's great. Awesome, right? So I think that's an interesting story. I think that's a really good example of the fact that you can feel pretty certain that you are dealing with the problems that are apparent, and you're just going out about it in a way that does not make a lot of sense upon closer examination. In other words, what they wanted to do initially was they wanted to treat a symptom of what was happening, not the actual root cause, right? This was just a side occurrence of what they were trying to fix, but they were not actually getting to the issue at hand. Okay, another example of this. I want to go for second one here. So we have this groundbreaking study on addiction called Rat Park, and it's really interesting. Rat Park was done in the 1970s by professors at the University of British Columbia, and it's sort of this landmark study on addiction. Now, if I ask people what causes addiction, particularly teens, the most common answer you get is exposure. Thought process goes like this. You get exposed to something that is an addictive substance. The result is you get addicted, obviously, right? I mean, it seems so clear. You have, like, everyone who's addicted is addicted to something, right? So obviously they were exposed, so it's addictive. We got exposed, right? So Rat Park challenges this theory, and it actually seems to explain better why, again, So addiction, sort of that thought process about exposure causing addiction, is sort of the opposite. Instead of only pulling the survivors, like in the case of the planes, you're only pulling those who got caught up, who actually got addicted, but you're not actually looking at those who didn't. Because the reality is, lots of people get exposed to addictive substances, don't get addicted, right? Not saying go try it out. That's not the idea. The idea is that there's something more complex going on here. So in Rat Park, what ends up happening is that they take these rats and they do two sets of rats. Set of rats number one, they sort of put alone in a cage all by themselves, and they give them two options to drink every day: water and water laced with heroin. And then they see what happens. Like, every rat goes and drinks the heroin, dies. Boom. Sounds like exposure, right? Here's the problem. They also do a second set of rats, and they put them in a park. It has things to do, lots of wheels to play on, mazes to do, and lots of other rats. So they get to interact with all the other rats, and they get to play around, they get to do fun things. Guess what? Like, none of the rats get addicted to heroin. Isn't that crazy, right? It looks like exposure is what causes addiction, but studies like Rat Park and other studies have sort of fleshed out the concepts of addiction. That addiction is has a lot to do with things like genetic predisposition, and has a lot to do with, you know, exposure. Definitely, exposure is a part of it, but that another really essential part of addiction is that addiction is a way that you cope with things like an inability to know, like, if you don't know how to deal with boredom and boredom becomes threatening to you, it becomes really difficult to deal with, addiction becomes a coping mechanism, a way to escape the boredom. And if you feel, you know, like you are alone and you have nobody that you can turn to, addiction can be a solace for that, right? It's a coping mechanism. It's not just a result of being exposed. Oh, I liked that. On I go to addiction. It is also a question of how are you using addictive substances to cope with your life. Interesting, right? I've given two examples of a really important principle. It's that just because it looks like one thing causes another, that does not necessarily, it doesn't always play out that way. Upon closer examination, you can see that there might be a more complex story going on. And that's really important to remember because, you know, if we live in a cause and effect universe, a universe where, you know, the X happens as a result of Y, then the way to deal with effects is to address causes. But if you get those backwards, or you're seeing a really simple version of the story and not seeing a more complex version of causes, then it's really hard to address. It's really hard to address the effects. So I've been a teacher now for 15 years in the homeschooling community. So maybe I think that I'm not sure. I think that puts me maybe on the upper tier. Obviously, I'm in moms. They have all the experience in the world on me. But as far as actually being a professional teacher in the homeschooling community, I think that puts me sort of toward the upper end of experience. And over that time, I have noticed again and again and again that we have a similar situation here in education. So let me tell you a little story. And I'm going to be telling you a number of stories about a number of students. And I'm not going to tell you who these students are. Obviously, these are sensitive stories. I'm not going to tell you when I had them over the past 15 years. So these are spread out over a long time. And I'll also note that a lot of these stories would probably sound an awful lot like your story. I mean, I think these things are pretty common among students, right? But sort of generic. Like, some of these stories are stories that I've had with multiple students, not just one. Okay, so had a really interesting experience with a student. As a student, obviously debate, I mean, it's an intense subject. Anyone here, I have a number of students who have done debate. They know it's intense. It can be charged, for sure. It can be hard, definitely. And so this sort of brings out the struggles in students, right? It calls forth the difficulty because you're putting them in challenging situations. What ends up happening is I have this student come to me and he's like, oh man, Sam, I think I just want to be done. Frankly, listen, I'm like lots of people want to be done. I'm fine with that. My class is not like sacrosanct or anything. You understand? It's a class and you can be done. But he says, I want to be done and I just want to know why. For me, it's important that you be done for reasons that really make sense to you, that you feel good about, right? And there are lots of those reasons. Anyway, but he comes to me and says, okay, I want to be done. I was like, okay, well, at least let's talk about this, okay? So we start talking about it. And basically what it comes down to is he just feels like a failure all the time. Can't get his homework done. Can't get his, when we have tournaments, he's always sort of backing out last minute. Just feels really terrible about his experience. And most importantly, feels really terrible about himself. Just really discouraged. And this is the way that it presents in his mind. He thinks, I am a failure as a student. As a result, I, feel bad about myself. Obviously. I mean, isn't it so obvious? If you do poorly as a student, if you're lazy, if you're a procrastinator, if you won't try hard, if you won't be brave, obviously, you're going to feel bad about yourself as a student. Easy. It's as easy as being like, yeah, exposure, that causes, because obviously exposure causes addiction. It's clear to see. I want to be clear, it's not that simple. It's not even close to that simple. So I present to him the idea instead, hey, I have a question. What if it's actually the other way around? Like, obviously, there's some truth to that. You don't do very well. You procrastinate. You don't make good choices. You're not going to feel great about yourself. But what if that's not what is primarily happening? What if that's not the primary issue? You understand what I'm saying? It could be both. But what if the primary issue is actually the other direction? That you feel bad about yourself, and so you end up making poor choices as a student, which gets you in this feedback loop. But the problem is you can only see one half of the feedback loop. You're seeing a really simplified picture that's not very realistic. All you see is, I make poor decisions, therefore I feel bad about myself. But it is more difficult and more subtle to see the way that students feel bad about themselves, and as a result, they end up being poor students. At the end of the year, I just want to give you an idea of how pervasive this is. At the end of every semester, I have students write what's called a semester reflection, and they're supposed to reflect on their experiences. I ask them things like, what did you learn about yourself? What was your biggest challenge that you had to overcome this semester, etc., etc. Do you know what students say when they assess why they didn't do well? If I've got a student that's not doing very well in class, what do they say? They say, I am lazy. I'm a procrastinator. I just won't try very hard. I won't take risks. The problem is just me. This is what students think. I would like to propose to you the revolutionary idea. That's not true. And the way I know it's not true is that very often I see students sort of get over the hump. I see students who stop procrastinating, stop being lazy, start taking risks, start being more successful. Do you know what they never say? Like, never. They never say, well, man, I started getting better. I stopped procrastinating. Do you know why? Because I just tried hard. I just tried real, 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 real hard. I wasn't trying hard before. Don't know why. I just didn't know procrastination was a bad idea. And then I was like, maybe procrastination's a bad idea. And then after that, they were like, oh, gosh, now I'll try hard. So they tried hard. Boom. Procrastination taken care of. It has never happened. How ridiculous does that sound? I guarantee every single one here at some point has been like, oh man, I gotta stop procrastinating, right? What, you weren't trying hard? That's so ludicrous. You're like, oh man, I better try harder next time. Because, gosh, I guess I haven't tried hard enough. You weren't putting in a strong effort to stop procrastinating? Doesn't this indicate that maybe there's something bigger going on? It is quite apparent to me that there is something bigger going on. Let me give you a story. Years ago, I had a student in one of my classes, and he really struggled in my class on a lot of fronts, lots of fronts. On the one hand, he didn't do his homework very much, right? That's plenty of students. I can deal with that, but he sort of couldn't deal with that. You know, we'd ask, okay, why not? And he'd be really defensive about it, very, very defensive. And then, not only that, but he's sort of aggressive to other students in class. It's like this classic bad spot to be in. On the one hand, he can't take criticism, but on the other hand, he's kind of harsh toward other people. He's really not succeeding as a student. Also, has a really hard time taking risks. You know, theoretically wants to go out there and put himself out there, but just can't pull the trigger. Really, really tough circumstance. Frankly, the kids in his class struggle with him. But I appreciate that they make efforts to be inclusive. I've always really appreciated that. I mean, that's one of the things I love most about the homeschooling community, is that on average, they're just really good at being patient with other people, accepting, loving, and not trying to, like, get people out of there. I think that's really good. So, that summer, he's deciding whether he's going to come back to my class for the second year. And I decided to have a talk with him over the summer, meet him, meet his mom. And we talk, and sort of talk about why the class is so hard for him. And he hems and he haws, and it's kind of hard, it's kind of difficult. And then I don't really know why, but either he finally decided to be honest, or he finally came to the realization. He shares this story, and it's heartbreaking. I mean, just heartbreaking. He says that years ago, you know, I don't want to get too specific, but he'd had this really terrible instance of bullying. Had a student, this kid, I mean, he's kind of hyperactive, you know, and he was in a class with some older student, and this older student really took it to him in a very publicly humiliating way. Really, really terrible. The sort of thing that that no kid should have to go through. Ends up with the kid kind of standing over him laughing with his foot on him while he's on the ground. Heartbreaking. In that conversation, he reveals a couple of things. First of all, he has trouble trusting me because I dress nice. I always have for classes. Maybe I'll tell you a little bit about that later. I always dress in slacks, shirt, but this kid was part of a group of kids that were kind of cool, and they always dressed real nice. Interesting, right? Didn't feel very comfortable around me. And not only that, but some of the other kids in the class were hard for him to be around. They thought, wow, you're hard to be around. Well, it turns out they're really hard to be around. Not for anything that they've done necessarily, but they sort of are cool. They are cool kids in the class, and cool kids really scare him. By the way, can you imagine how vulnerable you'd have to be to say this to somebody? Open up like that. And then it turns out that he basically spends all day, every day, arguing with this kid in his head, telling him why he shouldn't have done that to me. You didn't have any right. But he never seemed to convince him in his head that he didn't have the right to do that to him. Let's see. Why is this kid not doing his homework? Is it because he's bad? Oh, just a bad kid. lazy, irresponsible, won't work hard. This is why he's a bad kid. Or maybe it's because he's exhausted all the time. He can't figure out how to get this kid out of his head. Do you understand what I'm saying? There is often a much, much bigger picture as to what's going on. And this is a pretty extreme example, but it also happens with pretty non-extreme examples as well. So the title of this presentation is What is Holding You Back? And the purpose is to convince you, if you are experiencing significant difficulty as a student, or even sometimes kind of minor difficulty, it's pretty likely that the thing that's holding you back is not that you're a lazy kid and just a procrastinator. There's probably something else going on. Now, I want to move on to some specifics about that. So the question is, over my experience as a teacher, what is it that ends up being, if it's not just laziness and just bad kids that's causing kids to struggle, what is it? Well, I'd like to introduce you to some theories and some thoughts that might give you some frameworks for thinking about that. The first is Erik Erikson's stages of psychosocial development. And some of you may be familiar with that, but I would assume that most are not. So I'm going to give you an overview of that. So there was this psychologist. His name was Erik Erikson. And he developed this theory that's become one of sort of the foundational theories of human development. If you take human development courses in college, you're going to run into this. If you take any education, if you're in an education program, you're going to run into it. I remember it was a real revelation for me when I learned about this in college. But basically, Erik Erikson says that humans go through these stages, these conflicts throughout their life. And the first conflict is trust versus mistrust. And then after that is autonomy versus shame. And then you go through these, you know, at some point you do identity versus role confusion and industry versus, it means incompetence, but I can't remember what the opposite is, and so on and so forth. And to give you an idea of what this means, so there's this study, to give you an idea of like of what one of these means, let's take trust versus mistrust, right? There was this study, interesting study done, and I cannot recall the citation here. I apologize. I should have that on me, but I don't. Anyway, the citation for the study has these monkeys that get put in this room, and they're baby monkeys, and they drop the monkeys in the room, and if the monkey, and they drop, like one set of monkeys they drop in the room without mothers, and another set of monkeys they drop in the room with mothers, right? And so they put this monkey in the room without the mother, and what happens is in both cases they're in a new environment and the baby monkey sort of like huddles, just stays there, watches around, right? But then what are they going to do next, right? They've got all these toys to play with. Turns out that the monkeys that go in with their mother, they start to like go out and play, generally speaking, and the monkeys that go in without the mother never do. Right? The idea is essentially that the mother provides a level of trust for the monkey. I know I'm safe. I know that this place is okay. Okay, I feel safe. I can start to go explore. It's hard to go exploring if you don't have that. But on the other hand, if you have, you never get that feeling of safety, then you never get to the point where you can go and explore, right? That's what I'm talking about, trust versus mistrust. So in these stages of psychosocial development, basically there are these big questions that humans have to answer. Can I trust my environment? Am I an autonomous person, and do I get to say those things? You know, do I get to express myself as a human? Do I have an identity? Am I a competent person? So let's talk about how that might play out. Research has not demonstrated that humans actually go through these in stages like Erik Erikson said. Apparently, they can sort of happen anytime, really. You can sort of get tripped up on these. And it's not like it's like you resolve the issue once, resolved forever, right? Sometimes you have to come back and revisit these questions. So I'd like to identify some of the questions and what that looks like trust versus mistrust, for example. Can we agree that that student that I said earlier was dealing with a conflict there? That essentially he held an internal belief, I can't trust the world. The people around me are not safe. I'm not able to defend myself. And so I just can't put myself out there. That's a tough thing to believe. And if you can't get that resolved, it is going to plague you. For sure. Another example. So, autonomy versus shame. Autonomy versus shame is this idea, you know, am I an autonomous individual? Do I have the same rights as other people? Do I get to make choices for myself, et cetera, et cetera? So I'm teaching this class. I have this student. She comes in for her first tournament. She comes back, and after the tournament, I always ask students what they learned, right? She starts to talk. She's a talker, which is really good because being a talker helps you identify what's going on. So be talkers, which we'll talk about more later. Anyway, so she comes back and she says, man, like that was really tough for me because she was doing an event called Presidential Debate. And in Presidential Debate, what you're doing is like there are portions where everyone's trying to talk sort of at the same time. It's like a giant clash, 8 people all trying to take a chance to say something. And she says, that was really hard for me because I didn't want to be mean. So she's holding herself back. She's not saying stuff, not putting out what she thinks because she doesn't want to be mean. Dig into that a little bit mentally if you would. Like, what does that mean if she's like, I don't want to be mean. I don't want to, like, talk over somebody else. So they'll just have to talk over me. Do you see that there's an autonomy issue there? She doesn't actually perceive herself as important in the same way that other people are important. That the things that she says matter the same way that other people say things matter. You see what I'm saying? That unresolved conflict inside of her says, put your head down, don't talk, don't say anything, you're not worth it. Pretty sad, right? But thankfully, she was talking about it, and we were able to do that. And then the next time she came back, she said, oh, that was awesome. Like, I went in. I was talking over everybody. We were, like, going back and forth. It was great. It was huge progress. It was awesome. Right now, Eric Erickson, again, these are things that can happen everywhere, but Eric Erickson says that right now you all should be in the identity versus role confusion stage. What he says is that teenagers, they get into the teen years, and then they have like this central question they have to answer. Am I my family, or am I a separate person? Right? Do I have an identity that is my own? So I have this student that comes to me, and what's really interesting is that this is one of the most successful students I have. Right? He's awesome. Amazing. So good. Winning debate tournaments left and right. Accolades. Everyone loves him. Nobody would guess. Inside, really, really tortured on this issue. So he comes to me. He says, I just feel so bummed. He didn't get this part in this thing that he was doing. So he's like, I just feel so bummed that I didn't get this. I don't understand why. I feel so discouraged. So we talk. And we talk, and we talk, and we talk, ask questions, try to listen, reiterate what he's saying. And it's fascinating. We get down to this point where he says this. He says, I just don't know who I am if I'm not the best at debate. Who am I? I'm just kind of nobody. You see that there's an identity issue there? He's just not sure if he has an identity that's, you know, basically he's good at this thing sort of attached on, but he doesn't have a deeper identity. Doesn't understand who he is. And so, little failures, like this kid could, if it's art, he could fail all day long. Who freaking cares? You know? If it's music, no big deal. If it's debate, world comes crashing down. Because if he's not the best at debate, and not just good, I mean the best, then who is he? Interesting, right? Another one of these key issues is industry versus, it means competence versus incompetence. I need to memorize that other one. I apologize. So this is another one that I wanted to identify. Over the other, competence over incompetence. This one, Eric Erickson says you're supposed to experience this one about 10, 11, 12. You start noticing the differences of other people. You start being able to like mentally evaluate your skill level versus other people. And you encounter this key question. Do I fit into the category of competent people? Or am I in that terrible, no good category of incompetent people? Which one do I belong to? Have you ever thought about how hard it might be for a really severely dyslexic student to answer that question for themselves? How tremendously difficult that would be? Maybe you have a student who's on the spectrum, and that can be really difficult to measure that, to answer that question for themselves. To say, I belong to the class of really competent people, kids with ADD, ADHD, dysgraphia, or kids who are part of like this super talented family. Oh, my parents are amazing. My brother's amazing. How hard it can be to answer that question. Do I belong to the competent people or do I belong to the incompetent people? And it ends up causing trouble. I remember a student that I had who had severe dyslexia. And she's one of the people I am most proud of in this whole world. Really severe dyslexia. And every time I see her, I just almost want to cry. I'm so happy to see her. But I remember she comes into my class and is just sort of frozen. She gets up to give a speech one time and she's like, I don't know. Like, I don't have anything to say. And I have this other student who I'm super grateful for. This student took, you know, like 1 year of my class, hardly went to any tournaments. I'm so glad they were there. Because they said this to this other student. They said, you know what? Just do the best that you can, even if you don't think it's going to be very good. And she exercises just this little teeny bit of courage. And then she does the best that she can. And she sort of just keeps doing that day after day. Is she good at speaking? No. Her exposure to the written word is really limited. She has read not very much at all. And she has trouble processing information. It's hard for her. But that doesn't, I mean, does that mean that she's incompetent? Not capable? Those sort of circumstances make me wish I was a swearing person. Because I want to be so emphatic. No, of course not. But that's hard for her to see. Over the years, she builds up little bit at a time. It's like 5-6 years into my program, she starts placing at tournaments. She's doing well enough. She's built up her reading skills. Gets that question resolved. Yes, I am part of the competent group of humans. It's really awesome. But my goodness, the courage that took on her part. Huge courage. Have you ever heard of the imaginary audience, maybe? This is another philosophy. This is another theory of psychology. And it's made by a guy named David Elkind. I think it's David. Elkind is his last name. It's done in like the 80s. And it's this, and this one is also incredibly well studied. And this guy really hit it on the head. These studies have been reproduced over and over and over again. It demonstrates essentially that teenagers tend to have this really strong suspicion that everyone's looking at them. That they are sort of like the main character in a one-act play that involves everyone in the world as an audience. I don't know if you ever felt that way. It, when you ask teenagers, almost all of them will be like, no, no way. I've never felt that. But if you ask them, like, other questions, then they will reveal that they feel that way. Well, why don't we want to speak in public? I don't want people to see me mess up. You mean, like, everyone's sort of, like, paying attention? Like, they all care whether you mess up or don't mess up? You see what I'm saying? It's hard to admit outright. Interestingly enough, studies demonstrate that not always, but generally, girls experience the imaginary audience more than boys, but boys experience it plenty. And it peaks generally in eighth grade. Anyone here in eighth grade or like going in eighth grade? Yeah. Get ready. This is going to be fun. Usually that sense that everyone's sort of watching you and examining and deciding whether you're good enough sort of peaks in eighth grade. But it's really different for lots of different people. And it can be hard, and it can be debilitating. I had this student, and she does year one of the class, year two of the class, year three of the class. Everything's going great until year three. This student was sort of pretty extraordinarily gifted, so I let them in at 11. I usually keep kids off till 13, maybe 12. She was 11. She comes into the class, and things are going swimmingly. But the problem is that where most people start my class and they start speaking in public right when they're in the depths of that imaginary audience and they think everyone's looking at them, she starts and she's free. She doesn't feel it at all. And then all of a sudden she gets to her third year and it is like she gets buried. She cannot believe what's going on. All of a sudden she's like, I thought all these people were my friends, but I think they all hate me, you know, this sort of stuff. Really interesting. So we have these conversations, and you know what she does? She takes a year off. She's like, I just can't handle it. I try to talk her through it, but takes a year off. Is that because she's lazy, scared, dumb, bad? No! She's going through something really hard, and that's fine. It's not a big deal. It is a big deal if she says, no, what's really going on here is I'm just being dumb. I'm just being dumb. I'm just letting my fears decide what I do. That's just dumb. I mean, she is kind of letting her fears decide what she does, and that's not a great choice. But does that mean she's dumb? I don't think so. Takes a year off. Year later, comes back, and has a great year. She's had some time to figure out that, you know what, maybe not everyone is really looking at me all the time. We talked about Rat Park, right? And in Rat Park, the whole idea was that addiction is not simply, I like it, I got exposed, addicted, off I go. It's a coping mechanism. Have you ever thought, instead of thinking, oh, procrastination, there I go again, procrastination, I'm a bad kid. Have you ever thought about thinking about procrastination as a coping mechanism? A way that you deal with the world? A way that you avoid the things that you have difficulty confronting? Maybe you have not yet figured out how to deal with boredom. That's a really real thing. For some people, boredom is not a big deal, but for others, boredom is really hard. And procrastination is a way to put off things that bore you, because you haven't yet figured out how to deal with that boredom. Or maybe procrastination is a way that you can put off risk, not have to confront those internal beliefs. Beliefs like, I'm not safe, I'm just dumb, I don't really know who I am, nobody likes me, everyone's paying attention to me, everyone's going to see me mess up. Have you ever thought of procrastination as a coping mechanism for dealing with that? Because here's the deal. Up to this point, I can almost guarantee you that your strategy of, I'm going to try harder next time, is not working very well. But maybe the strategy of, I'm going to learn something new, I'm going to reflect internally and try to understand what's going on here, and I'm going to try to grow my way out of procrastination. Not... And this is important, because kids try to punish their way out of procrastination. Stop being an idiot. Stop being lazy. Stop being dumb. How productive is that when the real problem here is that you already have trouble liking yourself? Answer, it's not productive. It's super, super counterproductive to try to hate yourself out of procrastination. Punish yourself out of procrastination. Doesn't work very well. Have you ever thought about growing your way out of procrastination? Now, I'd like to talk about how to grow out of your way, but I think I'm getting real close here. So I'm going to try to keep this real brief. How do you grow your way out of the things that keep you from taking risks, from being lazy, quote unquote, etc.? Well, the first, I think, is that, one, stop the other strategy, right? Stop trying to punish yourself. The second is to introspect, to ask yourself at a deeper level what's going on. And to be honest about that. You don't have, and be patient. You don't have to make up some answer that's not, you know, that doesn't really answer the situation. Ask yourself, be patient, do the best you can in the meantime. Try to come up with good answers. But here's a really, really important one. And that is that talking really, really, really matters. There's an exercise I wish I could do with you. I love to ask my students to define what a bowl is. We always start with the caveat, you know what a bowl is, right? And they're like, yeah, of course I know what a bowl is. I say, please define a bowl. And they can't do it. They're like, bowl is something that holds liquid, like a cup? No. You know what I'm saying? They can't define it because it's all this stuff that's like their definition of bowl is all internal. But the more they try to define the bowl, and the more they bring things out of their subconscious, they talk about it, they examine it, the more they're able to understand the things that make what it is, the ways that they in fact define bowl. It's a really similar process. It's about going to your parents and saying, hey, mom and dad, can you just listen to me? I just don't feel good. Can you just listen to me while I explain that? And you know what? That phrase, will you just listen to me? That really matters. Because a lot of times parents want to be like, oh, let me fix this. And that's appropriate because, you know, they're your parents and they want to help. But it can be really valuable to just say, can you just listen to me and explain? Can you ask me questions? Can you help me try to understand this? I want to talk. Oftentimes when you feel terrible about yourself, the last thing in the world that you want to do is talk. It feels so counterintuitive. No, I'll just punish my way out of this. I don't deserve to talk. I'm a no-good nobody. So I'll just hate myself out of the situation, but it doesn't work. So having people that you trust, that you can talk to, that's key. I wish I could go on. I wish to tell you more of my story, tell you more about other students. I think we have to be done. So I'm really grateful you've taken the time to listen. I hope that you'll remember that in those moments that you feel like you're a terrible student, that somebody who's been with a lot of students and seen some students that have really struggled, that not once has he seen one that was struggling because they were just bad kids. I don't think that term makes much sense or is useful at all. So look for something else. I appreciate your time. You're wonderful people. Take care, everyone.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this record. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.